Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. I'm joined by Bobby Warshaw today and David Goldblatt. Man, I'm excited to talk to these guys. We're going to be hearing from them in just a minute. Later in the show, we have a conversation with Yael Averbusch, who currently plays for FC Kansas City of the NWSL, but she has played with and against Tobin Heath for most of her career. I think all of her career, basically, from college on. And we are going to talk in the second segment, the play, about the goal that Tobin scored on the weekend against Canada in the final of the CONCACAF Olympics playoffs. And man, it's such a good conversation. We've already recorded it, to be honest. Just through the magic of podcasting, I can go back in time and tell you that it's a great conversation. It's so interesting to hear someone with personal insight into the way a player as special as Tobin Heath plays talk about something she does on the field. So we have that. Before then, oh boy, if you want to know about the FIFA presidential election and some of these colorful, terrible people who are running to be president, you've come to the right place. David Goldblatt gives us a rundown of each of the guys. We talk about Tokyo Sexwale and Prince Ali and Gianni Infantino and what separates them, which happens to be less than what connects them, unfortunately. So stick around for that. Okay, you thought Hillary Clinton's campaign was uninspired and secretive. Wait until you get a load of these FIFA candidates. Luckily, we have David Goldblatt here to talk about the election on Friday with us. David, I want to start by asking you this. We're going to go through each candidate and just talk about some of their proposals, some of the, you know, what we can gather from what they've said, which is in some cases not all that much. But you know, the structure that brought us Sepp Blatter for so many years is still in place. These candidates, in order to stand, have to have the endorsement of at least, I think it's two or three member associations
in order to five.
Oh my God!
It used to be two.
In the election,
and right? Then Blatter panicked that more outsiders would take him on.
Right. So my question is: each of these member associations is in some way complicit with what has been happening in FIFA for so many years, to some extent. How much can any of these guys really be expected to change FIFA?
Not very much, actually, I would say at the moment. I don't want to be entirely cynical about it and rule out the possibility of change, but, you know, their personal histories and trajectories, their networks and allies, and their constituency inside FIFA are all compromised. And none of them, in, you know, what passes for manifestos, have really put forward a convincing case for practical institutional change and reform. So, no, not looking too good at the moment.
All right. Okay. So, we're going to talk about the candidates. I want to start, and we have to go through them in some kind of order. So, the order that I've chosen is by fabulousness of their name. Okay.
That is a superb decision.
I approve. So,
good.
Right. I think we can all agree that Tokyo Sexwale is definitely at the top of the list if you list it like that. So let's talk about Tokyo Sexwale. And just an aside here, I did go a little bit down the road of talking to an illustrator about what would a Tokyo sex whale look like, but we decided in the end that it would be maybe insensitive to portray that. So, but David, let's talk about Tokyo.
The whales or to him?
yeah, good point. I think to South Africans, I think was what we decided. Anyway, okay, so you know.
So he's an old ANC dude who kind of got his political chops in South Africa by being banged up in Robben Island with Mandela. In the immediate post-apartheid era, he was active in the trade unions and had a kind of real struggleista set of credentials. He made the decision, I don't quite know how it happened, in the mid-1990s to go down the route of black economic empowerment, as they refer to it in South Africa, whereby a very small number of highly connected individuals acquired significant stocks, shares and board positions in a variety of large South African companies, creating a new black economic elite in the country. And he rode that train really superbly. I believe he's even, up the stakes and got himself onto the South African version of The Apprentice. So we have a little sort of Donald Trump-styly South African politician here. He's dabbled in football. He certainly was part of the 2010 World Cup set up, though not particularly active. I believe he's held positions on the South African Football Association, neither of which cover one in glory.
Right, so just a little refresher. Which are the World Cups that we know there have been some bribes paid for? I mean, we can talk about 2022 Qatar, 2018 Russia, definitely 2010 South Africa, 2006 Germany. What are the others? Just as a refresher. It's crazy, first of all, that there are that many, but let's just put that aside.
Prior to that, I think the Japan-South Korea thing, I don't know. That was kind of Havelange wanted it in Japan, South Korea. I think everybody agreed that it needed to go to the Far East. But of course, it was going to be Japan initially, and then the Koreans muscled their way in by conducting such a sort of sustained, brilliant campaign that they had to be included in the process. So quite what happened for 2002, I don't know. I'm not hearing anything about 1998, but I do know that the French government awarded Joao Havelange the Légion d'honneur. So, cogitate on that thought.
Okay. All right. Next up, we have Jerome Champagne. I speak up if you disagree about the order of these names being.
Well, I was going to say that was almost first. Tokyo Sexwali is pretty hard to top, but come on. Jerome Champagne with the correct French accent is pretty good. So Jerome is an interesting dude. He's originally a senior French diplomat and also a writer for France Football. He's easily the most sort of intellectually astute and well-read and kind of also sort of vaguely normal person out of the five. His issue is that he served as Blatter's general secretary in the early 2000s. Draw from that whatever you will. He was pushed out by Blatter eventually. They disagreed over a variety of things, and he sort of got out early before things got really nasty in Blatter's FIFA. So that gives him some sort of pretty serious credentials, both organisationally and to an extent politically. The other thing with Jerome that it's worth noting is that, as far as I know, certainly his campaign against Blatter last time, when he didn't get to stand, has been personally funded. He's put his own money up, and I don't think he's a particularly rich man. He's put his own money up, whereas Infantino has had $500,000 out of UEFA's budget to run his campaign, and I'm sure Sheikh Salaman isn't finding things too hard either on the money front. Right. The other thing with Jerome Champagne is that he's got a real record of activism involved in grassroots football politics in small nations around the world, in Palestine, in Micronesia, and he's actually got a serious agenda of change. I'm not sure that I actually agree with it, but if anyone's got a kind of agenda of change that really could deliver some sort of transparency and some, begin to put the reputational damage back together, I think Jerome is the only person anyone can contemplate seriously voting for.
But that's why I'm conflicted, right? Because on paper, he's saying the right things. He seems to be, he seems to be open to reform and wanting to do that. The problem is that he served in this FIFA for, for a long time. And so I don't trust him. I don't trust anybody who's been doing that.
Do you have the same feeling about voting for Hillary in the general election? I understand. And I agree with you. I don't want to vote for any of these.
I don't want to make this an American politics podcast, but I'll say that, trying to weigh whether or not having to have Hillary as the president is worth getting to listen to Bill Clinton speak when he gets to speak. So there's like a definitely like a seesaw effect going on in my mind with that. So I'll make peace with it if it happens. Definitely better than most of the candidates in the field. But okay,
I actually do have to interject with a question.
Yes. Yeah,
which I think has to do with this. Why do we have such a bad selection of FIFA candidates? Like, we as Americans, we kind of understand what leads to having the selection of American presidential candidates, or it's not fully clear. But, like, what are the credentials? What are the personal attributes, the skills? Like, why is it this group of people that are about to be FIFA president?
Well, the first thing is the restrictions on the candidature. So you've got to have been active in the football world, though that is, you know, obviously quite a loose term, for at least 2 years.
Which also includes, like, a million people, right? Like, there has to be some way to get a better group.
Sure, and then you've got to get the five FAs to put up. I mean, look at the people in football administration, dude. I mean, where are the competent, socially alert, clean-handed, but also globally connected football administrators?
So why is that, though? What's the career path to get there? What's the skill set?
Well, it all depends. There is no one career path, because the way football associations are politically organized varies.
Here's why. Let me take a crack at this, David.
Go on.
Okay, because, Bobby, if you think about a national soccer federation, right, it is nominally represents people, right, the people of that country. You know, you would say, you know, the people of France are represented by the French national team in some sense, right? The people of the U.S. are represented by the U.S. national team. But do we actually really get a democratic vote for who's running the U.S. soccer federation? No. I mean, it's a pretty complex system that elects Sunil Gulati to be running the USSF. And once that happens, then, you know, the person who's running FIFA has to appeal to the 209, I believe, people in Sunil's seat. Otherwise, the rest of us don't really have much of a say or a voice. And so it's just such an abstracted concept of democracy that it isn't democratic.
I mean, and to be blunt, the way most football associations are run in the world, you know, you have to be part of what we in the global north would perceive to be deeply corrupt networks of clientelism and patronage. I mean, that's what gets you to the top.
What does that mean? Give me layman terms for what that means.
Okay, basically, you've got to be able to, you come in because you're already connected to a whole bunch of people who owe you favors, because the decision is not made democratically, but by a small group of people secretly.
And how do you win those favors in this world?
How do you win those favors? By being rich is usually helpful.
Or that's a really good way to do it.
Or
yeah.
By being politically powerful with access to state resources that you can then dole out to other people. I mean, that's what really counts.
That's a question I've had for a while, so thank you for that explanation.
You know, I mean, imagine, you know, in a small state, in a small country, particularly with a weak economy, you know, you become president of your football association. I mean, not only is it keeping you and your family sorted out, but suddenly you have access to probably, you know, you've got 30 jobs to hand out. You've got a whole bunch of trips abroad to hand out. You've got air tickets. You've got 3 million quid coming over a 4-year period from FIFA. You're suddenly a very important person. You think how many...
You know, when I think about U.S. soccer, I think one of the problems with U.S. soccer is there's too many people that were first to the market. The problem with U.S. soccer right now and the coaches and the people in charge, that there's too many people who don't truly have credentials in a world market, but they were first to the American market. And that they're not particularly skilled in anything soccer, except that they saw a chance to be important and to make money, and they wedged their way in. And we're still in U.S. soccer weeding those people out. So I think it's fascinating to hear you talk about other associations throughout the world, especially the big ones, and including FIFA, that has a similar problem. There's people that wedge their way in for too many reasons that aren't soccer associated.
I mean, I think this is true, actually, of all sports. I mean, this is not just true. We could be having this conversation, you know, though with less money involved, about global volleyball, global handball. Well, you've seen what goes on in international athletics. So there's no shortage of this stuff. This
curling,
is a problem
curling,
right
so
across
corrupt,
the sector.
So corrupt. All right, I'm gonna get us back on track here. I want to take us over to, I don't know, it's a toss-up for me between Prince Ali, because his name involves Prince, and Gianni Infantino, because, I don't know, Gianni Infantino. What does that mean? Like,
He's playing a lounge somewhere in Vegas, isn't he? Doing his back catalog of hits from the 1950s.
Like, I mean, look, I don't want to like stereotype Italians here, but like, if he were in an Italian American, he would be like Baby Johnny, right? And that would be his. We were talking last week how you need like a mob name in order to be in FIFA. So he seems like maybe the best candidate in that respect. He also happens to have sewn up a lot of support from CONMEBOL and UEFA already, which makes me suspicious of him from the start. David, can you talk about Gianni Infantino?
Okay, so he's a lawyer, a Swiss lawyer, multilingual, served as Michel Platini's factotum and bagman for the last 10 years at UEFA. And he's only really standing because Platini was, along with Blatter, was prevented from standing because of the $10 million payment that Blatter signed off to Platini, what was it, 9 or 10 years late. From FIFA HQ. So he is, I think the interesting thing to note here is that in the past, the regional blocks of which you speak, UEFA, CONMEBOL, are less solid than they used to be. I mean, one of the things that the clear out at the top of FIFA and some football associations in the last couple of years because of the FBI and Swiss investigations means that the kingpins who used to, for example, Jack Warner, you know, sewed up all the votes and made sure everybody voted in the right way in CONCACAF. I don't think we're going to see quite such strict kind of block voting. We're talking, you know, split groups of delegates here. And I think Infantino has got the core of UEFA. But remember, UEFA includes like Kazakhstan. And Russia, of course, who are not always...
I almost went on trial to Kazakhstan this week and decided it would be a bad idea.
Why is that?
Apparently quite an undemocratic place.
It's not a very democratic place. I mean, all of the Central Asian nations that joined UEFA back in the day. So who knows what's going to happen.
Bobby, get paid, man. Seriously. Come on, you got a small window here. Get paid. Go to Kazakhstan.
I'm down to get paid as long as I know I'll get out of the country alive.
Okay. So David Infantino.
And so just to finish on Infantino, you know, he is he's sort of presenting himself as the reform candidate on the grounds that, you know, he's from Europe and Europe is straighter than everywhere else. You know, like, which is a very, very, very questionable.
No, that's total bullshit. I mean, that's
position,
total bullshit.
I have to say. And, you know, he's in bed with CONMEBOL, you know, who are the past masters of all forms of chicanery in global football. So I don't really take that too seriously. I mean, the question is, you know, is he the worst of two evils for me between him and the other front brother, Sheikh Salaman from Bahrain? I mean, I don't think there's any choice for me. It's got to be Infantino. Of course, I'm going to hold my nose with disgust.
No,
but, you know, his record on human rights is somewhat better. You know, the question is, he's going around saying that he's got African votes. I mean, that's interesting, you know, because Hayatou, who is the old Cameroonian dude who's been standing in for Blatter over the last 6 months, you'll notice how unbelievably silent he is. Never has a man drawn more fees from being on committees and said less in human history.
I do have another question for you. Just before we get too far away from that human rights concept,
yeah.
I assume that people that listen to this podcast will be like, oh my God, our best candidate is only because he didn't commit human rights atrocities.
Yeah.
So from a grassroots way, like, is there any way for us to change this? Now, I don't mean us, meaning like Sunil Gulati. I mean fans of FIFA. Like, is there any way forward for the person? And the answer might just be no, sorry, you're fucked. But for the person listening to this, like, is there any path forward?
Okay, so the short answer is, in the short term, like before this election, no. In the long term, you know, all things are possible. I mean, when this all blew up last May, I thought it would be a good thing, you know, to have a People's Congress alongside, for example, this Congress, you know, to actually put some pressure on and to highlight these dudes, what they're actually about. But, you know, organising as a kind of global football social movement is not easy. It is possible. I mean, you know, you think about the kind of demonstrations that have been organised against the WTO or other international organisations, or where pressure has been externally applied to what appear to be, you know, completely impossibly impossibly powerful organizations. It can be made to happen, but you know, organization.
Money. Bobby, we need you to organize your fellow players here. We need to develop a political consciousness among the rank and file here. I think that's the way forward. Let me move it to Prince Ali, David, who has some very interesting proposal on how to increase transparency in FIFA voting.
It's an extraordinary thing, which is to have transparent ballot boxes.
Yeah.
I don't really get the transparent ballot box bit. I can see he might want to say people should be able to cast their vote in complete privacy and then fold up the bit of paper, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that would ensure... So I don't quite see what the transparent ballot box does.
No, I think he's really mixing metaphors here in a kind of amazingly great way. It reminds me of, you know, John Oliver does these great, and now this, like, segments on his HBO show. And he did one recently where it was like, and now lawmakers using ridiculous props to make their points. And I think that what we have here is like... You know, I'm just imagining Prince Ali like pulling up in like the Pope mobile, like totally transparent box, sitting in there casting his ballot. But nobody can read what's on the paper anyway. It just doesn't make any sense. Talk to us about Prince Ali.
Well, Prince Ali was the main. He's the second in line to the throne in Jordan. He was previously a vice president of FIFA through his position on the Asian Football Confederation. Within the internal politics of the AFC, he was kicked out by Salaman and his allies. He stood against Blatter in May last year, for which we should all be deeply grateful to him, because, of course, that triggered, precipitated the whole series of changes that have brought us here. He was then, as he is now, a relatively decent man, low on charisma, high on money and inherited status, with a kind of modicum of a reform program, saying nice things. I can't really take him very seriously, to be honest. I think he's going to get about 30 or 40 votes, maybe. You know, maybe he'll come through on the rails towards the end, but I just can't see it. I mean, what I'd say of Prince Ali is that he lacks a streak of ruthlessness. I mean, if it was going to happen, he needed to make it happen last time. But I think he's been the stalking horse, you know. He did everybody's dirty work, and now somebody else is going to pick up Blatter's crown.
Okay, now the least interesting name, Salman. Salman.
Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim al-Khalifa. I believe, to give him
you put it that way, it's a little more interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's a Bahraini. He's part of a whole network of powerful...
Cousin to Wiz, I'm assuming, as well. All right.
Part of a whole network of powerful Gulf state princes, ministers, and sheikhs who have decided to make their way in the world of international sport. Where money, power, and secrecy can be made to count in a way that in a lot of international networks they can't. The main issue with this dude, aside from, I think, the certainty that he has absolutely no intention of reforming anything in any way, is that he was unquestionably placed on a committee during the uprising in Bahrain in 2011 with an agenda to seek out... traitors, in inverted commas, within the sporting world. Indeed, the notion of a sports crime was coined in Bahrain for sports people who had the temerity to protest over the lack of democracy in that country in 2011. And whether he has claimed not that the committee never met, that he never sat on it, and that it never did anything. And from what I can see from the documents in the public realm, none of those things are true. And certainly a significant number of Bahraini footballers, let alone other sports people, were arrested, imprisoned, and subject to human rights abuse for their part in the democracy uprisings there. So, you know, from where I'm standing, like, this man is a complete non-starter.
Perfect for the job,
exactly,
actually.
Exactly. that's exactly correct. He has, I mean, again, he claims that he has the support of the Asian Football Confederation. But, you know, man, that's everything from Palestine to Japan.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about that, David. You know, the Asian Confederation is just, man, it's interesting. But I want to ask about, like, representation here. Why are no East Asian candidates come forward? I mean, I know there was Chung a few years ago, a Korean guy. You know, how did the Middle East sort of lock up the Asian leadership?
You know, because they got time and money on their hands, and because the elites of many of these countries have made engagement with international sport, international sporting federations in general, and football in particular, to be a central element of state policy. I mean, Qatar is obviously the most extreme version of this. You know, but Bahrain has had a Formula One race, like, for 10 years. Bahrain has been spending money on international sport, seeking international profile and control within those organizations, you know, for, like, over a decade. So these people are really serious about it, in a way that the Japanese and the Koreans, you know, and they've had their World Cup, and Chung was the main man, and he got busted. You know, I mean, that's the thing. He got called. We'll see what happens to these dudes. But that's why it's a matter of state policy, time and money on your hands.
Okay. Now, I want to, Bobby, when you hear all this, I want to throw this to you. you know, this affects you really more than any of us. You work in the structure of which these guys are at the very tip of the hierarchy. What you know, what would you like to see out of a FIFA president that you know, maybe Sepp wasn't doing for you?
There's multiple ways to answer this. There's, like, multiple tiers in the soccer world, right? There's, like, Messi and Ronaldo, and, like, Philipp Lahm, and it probably impacts those guys more than it does me, because they have the World Cups, the UEFA Championships, and all that. For guys like me at the bottom part, it doesn't matter that much.
I don't think that's true. Probably. Really? You really believe that? I mean, I feel like it impacts you more because right now the people in charge are really accelerating, like, a split between, you know, the top elite teams who are making a ton of money and teams that are really struggling toward the, you know, who aren't at that very, very top 1% level.
Maybe if it's divided, I still think the level that most MLS guys are at, most Americans, the European countries that I was in, I think everyone I played with would be completely indifferent to it. And that's actually a question that I had for David. To give you an answer to that question, I know so little about what it impacts me that I was actually going to tell David to tell it how it impacts me, how it impacts the medium level pros like myself, how it impacts the fans. Because outside of picking the World Cups, outside of those major events, I don't know what FIFA does on a day-to-day basis.
Well, FIFA increasingly sets the... Well, FIFA makes the rules of football, of course. I mean, through the International Football Association Board. So all the issues about rulemaking in football, which affects everyone who plays and watches it, goes on. So, you know, I mean, it against some of these kind of issues, it may seem trivial, but the goal line technology issue in the end was a FIFA decision. I'm, of course, militantly against goal line technology. But anyway, so I was affected by that. The other thing is FIFA sets the rules for the way agents work. FIFA increasingly sets the rules for the way in which...
Which I can tell you, haven't been locked up in problems with this. And agents rule the world. Agents are everything.
Yeah.
You think so the coaches...
So where's the counterweight? If you want a counterweight to the power of agents and somebody being on their case... FIFA is the natural institution to be doing that. I mean, it's the only one. Okay. I mean, not that it does. I'm not saying it's doing a good job. What I'm saying is there's the institution that ought to be doing that. I mean, I think, you know, FIFA makes its own contribution as well, both in sort of tone as well as finance and governance, to the quality and texture of grassroots and professional football cultures everywhere. And it potentially has, you know, a lot of influence in terms of standard setting, training, as well as, you know, also sort of rooting out, if you wanted an agency that was going to actually have an impact on the levels of corruption and incompetence, the terrible, terrible incompetence and waste that goes on in football associations that sort of affects us all because it makes everything a bit more shit than it needs to be. You know, FIFA could be doing that once it's got its own house in order. So the potential of the institution, you know, is actually really quite great. And what it's already doing, I think, does have direct impacts.
Yeah, so George.
And it's like, you know, how long have we got to read sort of ridiculous? I also think, you know, it's like they put on the World Cup, and what the World Cup looks like and feels like, you know, in all its different forms, men's and women's, old and young, it's like that really matters to me. And, you know, I'd really like, you know, someone who isn't a complete asshole to be in charge of that. Putting it bluntly.
Oh, that's a good... But, George, to answer your question from a player's point of view, I think 99.9% of the players out there are just trying to make a paycheck. They're trying to survive. They're trying not to get cut, traded, benched. You know, these macro questions of what FIFA's doing are not on the list of things we're worried about.
So, David, looking back at sort of the history of the 20th century and some of the political changes that have taken place, a lot of them happen because labor sort of wakes up and realizes they have a stake in it. They are actually much more powerful when they combine forces than they had realized. That doesn't seem likely to happen here in this case. And Bobby, you can tell me if I'm wrong, if people in the locker rooms you've been in have sort of been actively involved in things like this. I don't believe that's the case. But David, what makes soccer a different case? What makes it less likely to happen? Because it feels less likely to happen in soccer than it does in, say, coal mining.
I think it's probably sport versus non-sport is probably the way to be thinking about this. I think this is probably true of, you know, baseball and basketball and all other sports. I think what you end up with so far is that you have had trade unions, you have had labor organization, and on occasion, as we know with, you know, baseball in the United States, sports players, trade unions can be fantastically well organized and powerful. What you haven't had is, you know, which you have had in the wider world, is trade unions that are committed to a political agenda that is about more than narrow economic enhancement. And not that there's anything wrong with economic enhancement or trade unions, you know, pursuing that on behalf of their members. But that, as far as I can see, it's been pretty much the be-all and end-all most of the time. Now, why the trade union movements, you know, of the sports world have been so much less radical and so much less politicized and so less linked to a wider social movement and agenda of change is the next question. I mean, I think it's partly to do with the kind of, you know, they're in a very particular segmented labor market with very short careers, which generates a different set of incentives and concerns from the rest of the labor movement.
How do you organize around the whole world? And we're not talking about organizing a little factory in Detroit, Michigan.
Sure.
We're organizing multiple already pre-unions throughout each country around the whole world.
Yeah, good question. I mean, you know, FIFA Pro is sort of meant to be doing this. I mean, there is a kind of international body that's has attempted to, you know, to do some of this. I mean, what makes for successful and unsuccessful labor organization? I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know
enough. And these people thought they were coming for a soccer podcast.
I tell you what would be good, though, is that we need representatives, not just at FIFA, but on every football association in the world. Where is the representative of the athletes, both professionals and amateurs? I don't see it. I mean, even the IOC, in its kind of unspeakably undemocratic fashion, you know, calls leading athletes to the IOC for a term or two to have their expertise and their voice. And you think, well, why on earth have we not got this at FIFA? Why on earth is, you know, at the English Football Association, at any football association, you know, you've got the most irrelevant time servers sitting on boards, and where's the players' representative?
I want to add that I think it's partly because the people who run soccer and sports in general have been genius at sort of framing it as not a business, but a social good, something that improves humanity. And honestly, I think a lot of fans, if they saw someone, you know, like Thomas Mueller or Messi striking because they didn't like what FIFA's up to, they would probably not be all that sympathetic to that argument. They'd be like, well, you make millions of dollars, you live an enchanted life. Like, what are you unhappy about? Why are you taking away basic pleasure of watching you on the weekend?
Mm.
And you know why players are less inclined to strike? And this is one of the problems with the MLS CBA. Is window of opportunity. You only have so long of a window to play professionally, and players don't want to give up a half season or a full season or whatever it takes.
I mean, yeah. And that's true. And you guys are also subject to like a pretty subjective, you know, sort of you know, the way that you're evaluated is so subjective. It's a coach. If a coach likes you, then they play you. If they don't like you, then they don't play. You can't look at a spreadsheet and say, look, I deserve to be playing. In most cases, I deserve to be playing. You're just shunted aside and your career is over, you know, if you make trouble.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think my original formulation is wrong. I don't think players do have the most power here. I think it's really the fans, and the fans have been so lame about demanding change, which means I think withholding their money, withholding their attention. We haven't done that. We've just been really, really, really weak.
Well, that's true. But, you know, we also need to be organized. I mean, it's like we all know this, but we also know that just sort of individual, it's only through collective action, you know, that it can be made to work. And it takes a long time to create collective, sustainable, functioning political institutions and movements. I mean, the labor movement, man, it took a really long time, you know, to get there. Decades and decades and decades. And, you know, and that really was a matter of life and death. So while I completely hear you, dude, I just say, let's not be so hard on ourselves. This is a big historic task.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. What would the equivalent be? What could we do that's like, is it occupy football or is it like ignore football? I could see a totally great movement coming out of ignore football.
I mean, both, you know, boycotts and you know, the occupation of public space are both good tools. I don't think, you know, there ain't no one silver bullet here, is there? It's horses for courses, depending on who and where you are and what moment. But there are moments for both of those strategies.
Okay, so I'm going to be watching the election on Friday morning, U.S. Eastern Time. David, I assume you're going to be up early on the West Coast tuning in.
Oh, I'll be there.
Let's go through, you know, we handicap this for us. Like, take, you know, who has an actual chance? I mean, Champagne seems like if we're talking about, you know, let's get like inside politics here. I'm thinking like Champagne against Infantino. Infantino feels to me like he's just probably locked up the vote that Champagne needs in order to have a chance.
I don't think Champagne. No? I think Champagne's got a chance. No,
really? He's not okay. Gonna, okay.
I'd be very surprised. I mean, I would love him to, but I, you know, the you've got to expect if you're on a kind of, you know, reforming clean hands platform, you've got to get Scandinavia, you've got to get Northern Europe, you know, your sort of natural constituency. And I think all of those are locked up for Infantino. So I can't see how, I don't think Champagne is going to be making the later rounds.
Okay, and then the rest, I mean, Sexuale to me doesn't really stand a chance. He hasn't really done much of
campaigning. I don't think he really wants anybody to vote for him, actually. I don't think he's too worried that he might actually have to do something if someone votes for him.
Right. And then the other two, Ali, you think is a little bit of a rube, it sounds like.
I just don't think, you know, he, even in his own releases, he's saying maybe I've got 30 votes. Right, so he's hoping he can hang in there, pick up some votes in the second or third round of voting, and emerge as the main opponent to Salomon. I don't think it'll happen.
That seems unlikely.
I think it's unlikely. I think we're looking, you know, Salomon versus Infantino is where this is going. And at that point, I really don't know how to call it. I'm not close enough. You know, I mean, most of Europe plus CONMEBOL against a good chunk of Asia and a good chunk of Africa, maybe with a bit of Africa for Infantino. I mean, that's looking too close to call for me at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you need to be privy to like some pretty back deal.
Absolutely, and everybody, there's a lot of lying going on, and people won't necessarily vote as they say they're going to vote.
I'm gonna stop you there because that's a serious accusation to throw at FIFA, David, and I don't know. let's leave it there. It's going to be very interesting, and we can talk about the outcome next week. Man,
look forward.
Nothing's going
to
change. I mean, let's just be clear about that. We started the segment by saying this. Let's end it by saying nothing is going to change. These people are all, to some extent, totally. You know, they're just the same. They're just the same as what we've had. They just haven't. You know, they just haven't been running people. So depressing. Okay. All right. David, thank you.
My pleasure. Lovely to speak to you, dudes. Bye. Yep.
See you, David.
Bye.
Bobby, if you were here with me, I'd be crying on your shoulder right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I am now joined. Bobby's still here. And Yael Averbusch, I just learned how to say that correctly, is joining us. Even though we've spoken before, you've been on the podcast before, you've written for Howler several times. Yael, thank you for joining us. Let me tell everybody, you currently play soccer for FC Kansas City. That's very important to know here. Hi.
And has played for the full team and has goals. So nobody better to talk about this
than the national
today.
Team. Yeah, of course. So Yael has been there, done that. And Yael, let's give you a chance to say hi to everybody. But thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. And good pronunciation on the name. Good job.
All right, cool. Okay, so Yael, the purpose of this segment we're calling The Play, and everybody listening, this is going to be a standalone podcast next week, which we're really excited about. We'll have more information about that next week. But so we want to look at a goal that happened last week. Bobby, can you introduce the play here for us that we're going to be looking at?
Yeah, so the U.S. women's national team is playing against Canada in the final, the quote-unquote final, of the Olympic qualifying tournament.
Wait, why is that a quote-unquote final?
Because both teams were through. So the game was insignificant. Both
still
teams
a final. Still
yes.
a final, man. Come on. What kind of soccer player are you? You're just going to turn off because you're both through? Come on, Bobby.
You're right. So they're both in the final. It's 0-0. Mallory Pugh has the ball on the left side. She dribbles through two players. She dribbles right at the corner of the box, attacking the Canada defense. And she slides the ball across for Tobin through, coming from the right side of midfield, to put away.
And Bobby, that was a great description, but I just want to tell everybody, you can watch the GIF on our website. If you go to howlermagazine.com/podcast and click on today's episode, there's a GIF of that play. So, you know, just go watch that too.
And it's cool because it puts the U.S. up 1-0, but it's also the exact same goal that they scored the game before. Pugh going on the left side and Heath finishing it from the right. So maybe it's something we'll see in the future. Maybe it's something they worked on. Maybe it's part of a bigger picture. And those are kind of the things we wanted to find out right now.
Okay, so I guess my first question, if I can ask this question, is Yael, we were looking at this and we were talking and so that ball runs right across Carly Lloyd, who's like pointing in front of her, like, hey, I want this right here. And I was saying it's pretty ballsy for Mallory Pugh, like, what, 17 years old, to like play a ball across Carly Lloyd, who's wide open. And I mean, it works out fine, but what did you see there?
Yeah, so in my opinion, when I looked at it again and again, I'm pretty sure she was trying to find Carly. I think, you know, Carly was open at the top of the box, and Mallory Pugh had the right idea to cut it back in that situation, because I think, you know, she was kind of ahead of the other runners coming in, so she knew she had to cut the ball backwards to those runners. And I think when she looked up, she was trying to find Carly, but luckily for her, Tobin was running in also.
Because you know what's funny? When you're the youngest player, you always kind of look up, and if you have choices, you give it to the highest status player. So like if there's two people open and one of them is Carly Lloyd, Pugh will give it to Lloyd almost every time.
But I definitely think she was trying to find Carly.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And also, but Carly Lloyd was also a better bet for that ball. I mean, if you look at what's happening, the defender who's closest to Tobin is actually takes a step or two to close down Carly Lloyd, but then sees the ball go across her and has to sort of change direction, right?
You know what I really liked about this play is that the three Canada defenders actually aren't in bad spots. You know, you have the front zone, the right center back is in that front zone, pretty much even with the near post. The second center back, the left center back, is kind of matched up with Alex Morgan. And the third center back is in a little bit of a zone, half matching up with Tobin. But Alex Morgan's near post run, and I will talk about this till I'm blue in the face, with the number 9 in every team, the first forward, half their job is to run across the near post, because it does exactly what Alex Morgan does in this position. It pulls the defenders with her. So all of a sudden, the two center backs for Canada have to drop 3 to 5 yards. And that creates a big gap for either the second center mid with the Frank Lampard run or the wide player to come and attack the ball. But this all comes down to Alex Morgan doing the unselfish thing, going where she probably won't get the ball, but it drags the defenders out.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to point out too, I mean, on that note, that I don't think it was extremely poor defending or anything on Canada's part, because actually when the ball is played across, Tobin is still outside the box. So not that you don't need to be aware of those players, but if somebody is kind of heading towards the end line, you don't need to be matched up tight man-to-man outside the box. Your first concern should be the run that Alex Morgan's making, which they did take care of, like you said.
Yeah, it's also a very nice finish. I mean, you know, that's not a high percentage necessarily shot right there. I mean, from close to the top of the box. I mean, first timing it, changing direction like that. What do you guys make of that? Is that something you would practice in training, like a shot from that angle, come with the ball coming from that direction, or is that just Tobin Heath being really good?
Honestly, I think this is Tobin being Tobin. It's like everything you're told not to do, probably there every time you would teach a player, you should try to hit it back where it came from, mm-hmm. kind of far post or bend mm-hmm. it far post, I would think. I would never really recommend someone tries to do that. But that's what Tobin does. She does things that you're not supposed to do, and she makes them work. So yeah. I think it was one of those, to be honest.
Give us more insight into Tobin's mind on this. Like, when she sees this play, you played with her both in college and beyond. Give us insight to what she might see here. Like you said, does she always want to do the unexpected? I mean, what kind of things is she thinking while this ball is rolling towards her?
Yeah, I think Tobin likes to do what's fun for her, which is kind of a little bit more of the tricky and unexpected play. And I think that Tobin would have tried to finish like this probably 9 times out of 10, and maybe 8 of the times it wouldn't have worked. I think that, you know, Tobin doesn't do the conventional thing really ever, and that's part of what makes her really special, because no one knows what to expect, and she trains that way as well, so she's able to pull it off.
Well,
so
I would say, why does that work for her? Give us like insight into why that matters for a player like Tobin.
I think Tobin's just special in the way she grew up training and playing with the ball. So all the things that look like, whoa, how did she pull that off? Really, she's trained. So it's not magic in the sense that you see Tobin, you know, pull off a crazy move or meg someone or finish like this, and you think like, wow, how'd she come up with that? But that's the way Tobin plays all the time, whether she's training with the national team, training at home, or just, you know, you see Tobin anytime she shows up at practice or at a field and there's a ball around, even if it's not her training session, she's messing around with the ball and trying things. So really what she's done is, just through having fun with the ball and, you know, being free to give it a try, she's actually over the years trained a ton of reps of things that are just very different than what a lot of players do.
On that note, I saw you guys play Stanford in college at Stanford, and I'll never forget Tobin and Casey Nogueira warming up before the game, and like half the team was playing possession, a few people were finishing, and Tobin and Casey were just standing in the middle of the field with hoodies on, juggling with each other. Like, but like not like technical juggling. They're like doing, you know, around the world and over their heads and tricks. Literally like 15 minutes before number one versus number two in the country. And I'll never forget that. But I don't think you can teach that, right? Like that's what makes a player once in a generation. That's what makes a player start for a world champion, is that like little spark, that personality to them.
Yeah, and I think that's actually what you try not to teach, to be very honest. You probably, I would say that, you know, if you look at the things Tobin does and her preparation and the way she plays, you wouldn't tell most players to play and act like that because they're not Tobin, which is, it's a, like an irony in and of itself, because you wouldn't teach someone to play the game like that, but I wouldn't tell Tobin to play any other way because it would take away what makes her special.
To go back to this play, what does the why, like, when the ball comes across, first of all, it's amazing that Mallory doesn't just whip it in. Too many wide players just whip the ball in, and it drives me crazy. She picks up her head, she finds a space. But as an attacking player, yeah, when you're attacking from the midfield position, what do you expect? Do you go top of the box? Do you go far post? Like, how does United States frame this goal to successfully get on the end of the ball?
I mean, I agree with you that I think I've seen too many times players kind of get wide and don't have the ideas, so they just send it in there, which, to be honest, sometimes works. And it
crazy.
Definitely,
my
yeah, definitely worked a lot. It worked a lot though with Abby Wambach
yeah,
on the team.
Exactly.
So there were, it was like setting yourself up for at least a 50% chance of a goal. So I don't blame anyone who did that in that situation. But I think, I'm sure that with Jill Ellis, the team has worked on different types of crosses now that Abby is not on the team. And I think, like you said, this was a really good decision and really good awareness from Mallory Pugh. I think also the team has to know that Carly is going to be making that trailing run out of the midfield a lot of times and be in that top of the box spot, which is, like you said, probably the best pass she could have played there would be to find Carly in the middle of the goal at the top of the box. I mean, there aren't many better situations for the team there. So I have a feeling that's something that has been talked about and trained within the team environment. But if not, it was just you know, very good awareness from Mallory, and I think potentially it could have helped that they were kind of on a little bit of a break. So she had to have known that there weren't going to be, you know, tons of players in there making near post, far post runs. You had the near post run from Alex Morgan, and everyone else was trailing in a little bit behind her.
So I know you guys said that Canada didn't really do anything wrong here. I want to ask about what, you know, in retrospect, what would they have done differently? I mean, to me, the obvious thing is that big pocket of space sort of between the penalty dot and the tip of the arc that sort of is beautifully wide open for Carly Lloyd to run into. What do you guys see? I mean, you're both central midfielders too, right? Yael, I think you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and that to me seems like it probably, you know, y'all's space there that you're supposed to be sort of trying to close down?
Yeah, I would say a lot of that probably goes into further back than what the highlight, you know, the 30-second highlight clip shows, because I know as a midfielder, a lot of times I watch a highlight clip or a low light clip of the other team scoring, and they're like, oh, why weren't you at the top of the box? But who knows? You know, I can see Desiree Scott kind of tracking back in there as I'm looking at it on my screen. But who knows what kind of work she had just been doing up the field and was transitioning back. So I think, I mean, yes, obviously you need players clogging up that area, but I think that could have had to do with what was going on just prior.
Right,
to
and there are three players chasing Mallory Pugh, which seems to suggest that something else went horribly wrong right before that as well.
Well, you think when you're playing the best team in the world, which the U.S. is, at the end of the day, like, Tobin had an off-balance contested shot from 17 yards. So if a team's going to counter you and kind of come 3v3, which is what they were, at some point you have to think, if you're Canada, that they'll take that. Like, they'll let the United States have that shot. The problem is they are playing the best team in the world, and they took it. But just because the United States scored doesn't necessarily mean Canada did anything wrong. You know, it was one that U.S. executed well, and you have to give the U.S. credit as much as point fingers at Canada.
Yeah, I agree with that. Also, I do wonder why three players had got sucked in on Mallory Pugh, because just looking at that, that's probably where the imbalance occurs. And the only other thought I had on this was that the player who comes out, their left back, Canada's left back, comes out to pressure Tobin. Initially when I watched it, I was being really critical. I thought, you know, could she have closed her a little harder? But then I thought again, you know what, it's Tobin. Anybody who knows Tobin at all would exactly. not, because you get cut the second you do that. And Tobin would have cut inside and had even more time to finish. Which may have actually been harder for Tobin because it would be a more traditional finish, but that's a whole other story.
Oh man, guys, I got to say, it's so cool to talk to people who have experience with this, and especially Yael, with you knowing Tobin Heath so well. I mean, man, you don't get this kind of you don't get to hear this from most people. So I'm really thank you for coming on and sharing this with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, Bobby, have you satisfied your curiosity about this player? Do you have anything else to ask? Yael?
No, that was awesome.
All right, Yael, that was great. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Okay, so it's just me now. I asked Bobby if he had a Tiki Taka, and he goes, dude, I haven't been on Twitter or the internet or anything since yesterday, because I still don't know the score of Bayern Munich against Juventus. So nobody call Bobby and tell him the score of that game. It also means he doesn't have a Tiki Taka. I have a Tiki Taka. It's something you would know about if you subscribe to Howler's Goalmouth email. On Monday, Brooks linked to one of his own pieces, which was sort of like just a breakdown of the different groups of death, and sort of making fun of the whole concept of groups of death for the Copa Centenario. And it's really funny. I'm going to read a line that sort of sounds to me like a great Zen koan about soccer. Matchup of doom, the U.S. versus the concept of the group of death, TM. The U.S. keep ending up in groups American media label as the group of death, TM. But maybe if you're always in the group of death, TM, you're not all that alive. Something to think about. Yes, and he also writes about Neymar. says, while Ecuador could give Peru, who finished third at the last Copa America, trouble for the second place spot, Neymar's focus during the group stage will primarily be on impressing corporate executives so he can develop his brand in the U.S. market. Matchup of doom, Neymar versus Haiti. If he plays the full 90 minutes in this one, he will likely be awarded the tournament's golden boot on the spot. So for analysis like that, which I highly recommend you read, internalize, repeat, often, you should go to howlermagazine.com, sign up for the Goalmouth email. You do that by scrolling down on the right side, clicking on the little box, typing in your name, etc. You know how this works. And that's going to do it for today's podcast. I'm going to do the credits right now. The credits. Okay, I want to thank Yael Averbusch. I want to thank David Goldblatt, Bobby Warshaw, of course. I want to tell you that we have our new producers, who you've heard these names for, but it's Wes Burdine, Nick Jansen, Faisal Sikdar, great team there. I want to recommend that you go follow Howler on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We are at What a Howler on Facebook. That's just facebook.com/whatahowler. You will find some fun stuff there. David Rudin is our guy on Twitter. I think he's very funny. So go and follow those places. You can go get the new issue of Howler, which is going to be coming out in the next month. We have it shipped to the printer this week, which is very exciting. We have that coming out. You can pre-order it, all that stuff. My name is George Qureshi. I host this podcast. We'll be back next week with all the rest of the dummies that we know. Until then, just remember that when you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.